Good evening, good citizens. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and this is Dante's Old South. Again, I'm not going to waste your time with a long hello, but I do want you to know that if you want to know more about our guests, yours truly, or our affiliate magazine, the Blue Mountain Review, just go to our company website, www.southerncollectiveexperience.com. Before we kick it all off, I want to thank a few folks. First of all, there's Lucid House Publishing, run by Echo Garrett, a press devoted to representing all voices with style, beauty, and grace. Then we have The Crown Restaurant out in Brasstown, North Carolina. The Crown Restaurant is a gluten-free paradise that anyone would enjoy. That's just around the corner from John C. Campbell Folk School. Mercer University Press, a press in Middle Georgia with 50 years of quality authors under their belt. The UCLA Writers Extension Program, a program that offers courses in all disciplines to help you get ahead in the industry of creative writing. Then there's NPR and WUTC. I want to thank them for their dedication and faith in this program. And last and not least, Richard Winham and Michael Amade for producing and promoting this madness, as well as being my best friend. Whew. Here we go, y'all. Let's listen to Hope and Sorrow by Wilder Atkins.
Water moves, it ebbs and flows, burns like fire in my soul. It shakes in ways I can't control and can't even explain. Oh, the love of God is deep and wide, the heart of God, beauty divine. Love of man's a fickle tide, why do you love us so? And oh my word, how bittersweet this life, with hope and sorrow intertwined. I knew my father well. Maybe one day we will sit a spell, stare deep into that holy well of eyes so blue and gray. For your demons are the same as mine, and in choosing words you take your time. You are a poem that doesn't rhyme, but it is beautiful that way. And oh my word, how bittersweet this life, with hope and sorrow intertwined. Brother is a lonesome man, on whom the shadow did descend. But brother, I would be your Samaritan, or I would walk through fire for you. And oh, the sky may fall and the earth may quake, the rafters and the walls may shake, but it's the little things which separate a brother his own. And oh my word, how bittersweet this life, with hope and sorrow intertwined. Bittersweet this life, with hope and sorrow intertwined. Oh.
Chelsea Clammer, an essayist, an editor, and creative writing teacher in Austin, Texas, is here with us this evening to talk about her life, love, and letters. Chelsea, how are you doing?
I'm doing most fabulous. Cliff, how are you doing?
I'm fine and dandy like sour candy, but it's not about me. It's about you. What's your story, Morning Glory? Where'd you come from?
Man.
Where are you going?
Man, long story short, born, well, maybe it's not too short, but, you know, like born in Wyoming and lived in Colorado, California, Texas. Eventually found myself in Chicago when I was doing a master's program, women's studies. And I'm just getting to the story that I find important, which is where I used to get really drunk, which isn't the important part. But I eventually got sober and writing is what saved my life. And so That is my story. Morning Glory is talking and about writing because I'd live for it, and it's what saved me. So that's me.
Getting sober and staying sober. You returned to teaching a school where, as a student, you went through a hard time, and it's a unique experience. So in talking about that, if you don't mind, let's piggyback that on the fact that you are a creative writing teacher and that you have a unique way coming to this profession, learning by doing and teaching by doing. Tell us a little bit about all of that.
Yeah, super interesting. So I'm teaching at a university. I also teach online classes, and I've never taken a creative writing class. I have a master's of fine arts in creative writing, but it was from Rainier Writing Workshop. It was an awesome program, but it was one-on-one with a mentor for 3 years. So like we had a residency where we would sit in like little classes, but I never took like a 14-week in-person college course about writing. And so my approach to writing is just like learning through how other people give me feedback, and most important, how people revise and edit my work. That's how I learned writing, you know, like looking, and not just like grammar and whatnot, but really looking at the way that something flows and having people be like, no, this could go elsewhere. And just seeing what they did with my work is the way that I learned how to write.
Teaching others how to write, you come at it sideways through editing, the back end, the technical nuts and bolts of the process. Your students have taken to it. Tell us what that means to you to come in sideways and editing, and how you think that maybe it's probably a more productive pure form to help someone learn how.
Yeah, like I feel like with my students and with myself, writing is just like the blah, I got all this out of me, you know, like here's my story, I got it out. And that can be the hard part, but I think where the real writing happens, and this is what I'm teaching them, is through the revision process. And you come in sideways in the sense like you approach it from different angles. You're not just barreling through it, but you like take a piece of it and look at it from a different perspective. And then you approach another part of it from a different perspective. And I'm coming up on the weeks where we really focus on revising. But like one of my favorite things to do is I'll print out my essay, literally cut it up paragraph by paragraph, just lay it on the floor. And then I read through each paragraph and I'm like, okay, this one could go first. Oh, this would be a much better paragraph to go after that. And I rearrange the whole thing. I get me some scotch tape. I tape it together so I have a scroll of writing. And I copy and paste into a new document and I have a new essay. And it's just like, it's instead of just going from beginning to end and trying to figure it out, like I have to step into it in the sideways sort of way where I look at it literally above it from different perspectives and see the whole thing in front of me and how it's working and flowing. And it's kind of like a river that you try to go with the bends and try and control it and dig out different ditches to see which way it can go. So that is my revision and teaching process.
Tell me why you have such a passion for in your writing and to speak on structure.
Well, you know, it's kind of like structure is how I feel like the reader experiences the piece. And you can have a linear structure, you can have chronological, and that's fine and dandy, and it's not a bad way. But the way that my brain works is that I don't think in a linear sort of way. I mean, and especially like I write about hard topics. And so I write about like the alcoholism and sexual assaults and mental illness and abuse. And like, we don't experience those things in a linear form. We don't remember our trauma in that this and this happened. It's these flashes of moments that come to us. And so that's how I feel like it should be represented in writing through different sorts of structure, whether that's a mosaic piece or a woven braided essay or just some weird structured list essay, which I love dearly, or even the hermit crab essay where it takes a different form of writing that already exists. But it's like the experiences that we have, yes, it happens chronologically, but we don't remember them in a linear way. And so I feel like forming a structure that fits your story really enhances the reader's experience of how they understand that you experience something.
Tell us about the books that you have out now.
I have three books out now. Back in 2015, I published Body Home, which, interesting story, I actually wrote it in like 2012. It was the first book that I wrote. I got sober and wrote a book. I basically replaced the drinking with the pen. And I wrote a book just writing out my experiences, and it sat around for a year. It never got, it had 62 rejections. And I was like, okay, practice book. So then I entered my MFA program. And in the first 2 years, I wrote another book called Circadian. And one of the essays in Circadian, which I love, it's just a fun book. It's really weird. It is a weird book. But one of the essays I submitted to a contest, and it won the contest. And the woman was like, hey, I really like your writing. Do you have a manuscript? And I was like, well, I'm still working on Circadian, but I have this book called Body Home. And so I sent her the manuscript. She loved it. They published it. So then a few years later, I think I'm so bad with dates. Circadian, after I finished it in my MFA program, I graduated in 2016, but in 2015, I entered it to Red Hen Press's contest solely because I didn't want to write a book proposal. I hate writing book proposals. I got 62 rejections of my previous book proposal. So I submitted to places where it didn't need a proposal, such as a contest. And, you know, it won. Awesome. So Red Hen Press published that, and then they got first dibs on my next book. And so I worked on my latest book that came out in 2022. It's called Human Heartbeat Detected.
You're going to read a piece from one of your books. Which book is it? What are you going to
read? This is from Human Heartbeat Detected. It's super short. It's just a fun little essay. I teach it in the classes that I'm teaching because it's just fun. It's called Control Alt Delete. So here we go. Consider yourself a task I have ended. Our relationship a 404 not found. Our connection now disconnected. You, a broken link I wish I had been forbidden to visit. A threat I did not initially detect. You became a virus in my system, and I had to malware you out of it. I have now completed the uninstallation process, have reset my life's device back to its original settings from before 5 years ago, when I mistakenly trusted your download of lies. So good luck spamming your way into someone else's unregistered trust. I have already reported your corrupted files.
It's so good. It's... It's and when I've read Circadian, you have, in my opinion, one of the highest virtues in the toolbox of a writer, in that, like, in what you just read, it's got the right amount of snark in it.
I love the snark,
but it's not angry. It's not like, yeah, this is what it is. I feel like when you read it, it's that's the feeling we all feel, you know. Yeah. And so you carry that through all of your work, you know, your fingerprints on your work. For me, it helps me get comfortable in the page. You're very present in the work because you're not talking at me, you know?
No, I feel like I'm talking from me, and you know, I am a snarky person, and I think that's because like I've just been through so much, and you got to approach it with humor. You know, if we don't have the humor through the situation, then we just drown in the sorrow. And so you got to find the snark and look at it differently. Like one of my favorite lines in Human Heartbeat Detected, it's about me and a woman who we had a friendship falling out, and it's like me talking about the chances that we're going to get back together to be friends again. And I'm like, you know, the chance of that happening is roughly not going to happen percent. Because that's what it is. Like, yeah, yeah. You can't even put a decimal point on it. Yeah, it's not going to happen percent. So for me, that's just like a funny, quirky thing in this really sad essay about a friendship falling apart. And that's how I experience life, is you just have these weird little things that you're like, oh, that's kind of funny, even though it shouldn't be. And so why not put that in writing? It's my experience of it. And so it's not talking at the reader. It's talking from me.
Now, you've taken a lot of your new book from a stint in a very special place. I'd like you to talk about that as you give us not the title, but an idea of what the upcoming book is looking like and where you wrote it. Tell me about that story.
Well, the book that I'm working on is about the empowering women in my life. And so that includes me because, you know, that's my life. And so every other essay, one is about an empowering woman in my life, such as my mom, my grandma, my therapist. And then the other essays are about the way this that I have been resilient in my life. And I wrote the very first half of it in 3 months in 2019. I was the writer in residence for the Jack Kerouac Project in Orlando, Florida. So it was this little bungalow house that Jack Kerouac lived in. I think he wrote Dharma Bums while he lived there, if I'm getting that correctly. And they use it now as a house to host people to write. So in the fall of 2019, I wrote for 3 months. That's all I did. I wrote half this book. It was absolutely amazing. And since 2019, I've been working on the other half of it. And I have one more essay left, just one more. I'm like halfway through it. I have like a really terrible first draft that I'm working on creating, not so terrible. So I have a starting point. But yeah, and it's a like Human Heartbeat Detected. People who have read it are like, I've had to take it in bits because there's so much trauma in it. I'm like, I know, I'm sorry to traumatize you with my writing, but that's what it is. And this book, it's not traumatizing in the same way, but it takes like the trauma of our lives and shows the ways that the women who I've known have been resilient and worked through that. Whether that's somebody who actually used meth and addiction to work through her grief, you know, that's how she was resilient. You just accept that. Or my mom to work through my dad's suicidal tendencies. She was a jazzercise instructor, and it was jazzercise that got her through those rough times. So it's looking at, you know, just the different, both healthy and unhealthy ways that we find resilience in our life through the different traumas that we face.
We all want to see more of your face on the page. And for us to do that, we need to get our hands on your books. Where do we go online to buy your books, find out more about you, and to keep up with your book to be?
Yeah, so books can be found anywhere that you can order a book from. Their main publisher, so just go find a book. Or if you want one from me personally that I can sign and send you, and if you want, I can even knit you a bookmark that matches the cover, because that's something that I do because I'm crazy like that and I love it. My website is my name, ChelseaClammer.com, and that is Chelsea with a Y, because my mom wanted me to be special. So I have a Y, ChelseaClammer.com. And on there, I have information about, you know, all of my books, the classes I teach, how you can contact me. And I'm also an editor, so I have all of my information on there about how you can hire me to be your editor, because that's like my life passion aside from writing. The two are enmeshed for me. So you can also hire me to be an editor, and that's what I do. So all on my website, or you can stalk me on Facebook. I post all the time. I'm just Chelsea Clammer on Facebook.
You're far more than just Chelsea Clammer. But Chelsea Clammer, it has been beautiful to have you on this program. And you're going to be in the upcoming Blue Mountain Review alongside Billy Bob Thornton. We are very excited about that.
I'm probably more excited than you are, but thank you.
It's my pleasure. Now, if you need anything from me, you let me know. We're going to have you back on the show soon.
Thank you. It's been super fun to be here.
Now let's hear Bright as the Sun by Patrice Pike. Thank you.
the surface when you focus. So many people with hollow eyes, feeling hopeless without a purpose. I tell my
Our next guest is Elizabeth Cox, a novelist with Mercer University Press, with her first book of essays out now. Elizabeth, how are you doing?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me.
It is an honor to have you on. And as I typically do, I begin at the beginning, and I'll do so with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, or a lot about yourself, whatever you want to do.
I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I grew up on the campus of a boys' school where my father was headmaster. My brothers and I grew up there, and it was a beautiful place set in a bowl of mountains right on the Tennessee River. And we've all three been affected by that place, that sense of place. My older brother, Herb Barks, was a minister and then was head of the school for a while. My other brother is Coleman Barks, who is a poet and has translated Rumi. And both of my brothers are in this book.
Well, let's talk about this book. Tell us all about this book, Elizabeth Cox.
Reading Van Gogh began about 20 years ago. I was working on a series of essays about the search for God, for a different life, for the inner soul, whatever you want to call it. And I was reading William James and Carl Jung, a lot of Carl Jung, Rilke, his book Stories of God, which are wonderful, strange stories. William James, Mary Oliver. I was reading a whole group of writers. And then I stumbled on Van Gogh's letters. First, it was those letters in a small book by Irving Stone and Cliff Edwards. They had those letters, and then they talked about the letters. But then I got the three volumes, huge volumes of letters, and read those because I was so struck how this man who had mental illness, poverty, isolation, was able to have a remarkable capacity for compassion. I was just struck by that, and I wanted to know more. And though I think I fell in love with him, I don't disregard his irascible personality, his manipulative way of being with people, his drunkenness. I don't disregard any of that, but his kindness toward people was an overriding force for me, and I wanted to know more. I found out that Van Gogh became a minister first. His father was a minister, and the sons and daughters, his brothers and sisters, went to church and heard his father preach, and they took food and clothes to the poor. So that's how he grew up. But he wanted to become a minister. He went to seminary. He studied theology. He hated theology. He hated the way the theology students and professors talked about God. It was more from the head than the heart. And so he flunked, but he so desperately wanted to be a missionary that the church allowed him to be a missionary in the Borinage district, the mining district of Belgium. I think nobody else wanted to go there, probably. And so they gave that to him for 6 months. While he was there, he had an apartment there. And he would visit with the miners. He would preach on Sundays, but the miners were so involved in their difficult lives that they weren't very interested in evangelistic sermons. They were more interested in how to survive. And Van Gogh jumped on their bandwagon. He was more interested in the way they survived too. He visited their homes when typhoid fever hit. He nursed them well. There was an explosion at the mine, and Van Gogh went to help them. He went back to his apartment, and he took food, and he took all his clothes. He took all his money, and he gave it to them. He took his bed sheets to bind up their wounds. He took his bed. He gave them everything he had. And he finally lived in the huts and was found in the corner of one hut, almost dead. His father and brother found him there. And the church was very angry about that situation because he wasn't preaching. He was just giving everything away. And so they did not allow him to continue to preach. They kicked him out. And Van Gogh, after this, didn't have many good things to say about the church or religion. But it did not stop his own search for God in his own way. And I liked his way. He liked his way of searching.
Well, when you sit down, or when you do sit down in general to write, are there rituals you go into, or, you know, how do you tackle that nefarious first blank page?
Well, I remember what Flannery O'Connor said. She was going to sit there in case it came. And some days I sit there a long time and I get one sentence or get nothing, or sometimes I get a page, or sometimes I get a page I don't like, but it doesn't matter. I'm just there. But I'll tell you, Cliff, I kind of, now that I'm retired, I kind of live in that space.
Right.
You know, I get to live because I don't have to be anywhere at a certain time or teach a class. So I live in that space. And I love it. It's a space my brother lives in all the time when he translates Ruby. He told me about that space. Yeah.
Bringing that up, what was it like to share that literary space with Coleman Barks? Because so many get bitter about it, and it's so refreshing to see you overjoyed with that connection. Do you mind sharing some of that with us?
Well, he's my big brother. We would go on walks and look at the world. And he looked at it in a way that I loved, but usually kept secret. But I didn't have to keep it secret with him. So that was just beautiful. I love talking to him. We share the same humor. And I'm happy with him. I remember when he first called me and told me, "Betsy, I am writing a translation of a 13th century Persian poet. You think anybody's going to read this?"
And they did.
And they did. Yes, they did.
And I have no doubt that you're going to draw your own audience for your own independent genius, because I've had a taste of it on the page. And Elizabeth, you tell true stories from fact that make people engaged and want to be invested in it, and that's a rare feat. And I thank you truly for putting that on the page for the rest of us to take part in.
Thank you very much. I'm just sharing as honestly as I can my own search, my own failures, the way Van Gogh did. He taught me a lot about that. Look hard at your own failures.
That's the only way you learn. Someone recently said, "You don't learn anything from success. It's always from the failures." George Clooney was saying, not like we're friends, but he had a video about the same thing. Like, success, that's easy. You know, it's the failures that you take the most from, if you look at it correctly.
Don't deny it, right? Exactly. And that's a Jungian idea, to look at not just failures, but at your darkness.
Yes,
because you cannot move into any kind of light without being aware of that darkness. And Amen. And Coleman introduced me actually to Jung. I've been reading him for years.
Well, so that more of us can read about you, tell us how we can find your books online.
Well, I have a website, elizabethcox.net. It's being set up now for this new book. And since that's not ready yet, but it's got my other books on it. And it's got where I've taught and information about me.
Right on.
I guess that's what you would find, where you would find it. Mercer Press is my publisher. And Mercer Press does the most beautiful books. And I've worked with Athenaeum. I worked with Random House, but Mercer Press does the most beautiful books.
And I know I'm biased as I have one there too, but I have to agree with you 100%. Elizabeth Cox, it has been amazing to have you on the show. And as you go out on tour to promote this book, please let me know and we will have you back on, okay?
Well, thank you. I would love to do just that.
And now on Dante's. We have a guest that is truly one of my dear friends and a hero for me in the poetry business, Dan Beach. He is a editor, he's a poet, and a translator. Dan Beach, how are you doing, Bob?
Great, how are you?
I am fine and dandy like sour candy. To jump in and put all 10 toes in the ground, I love to begin at the beginning. So, tell us the long and short about Dan Beach.
Oh, Lord. I was an innocent kid until I arrived at Harvard, basically, in the 60s during the huge Vietnam War protests. Little by little, I got turned into one of those terrible 60s anti-war radicals. And we had a lot of success. We had a lot of successful demonstrations. We got rid of ROTC at Harvard, several other things. But one of our demonstrations was for a Black Studies department, which Harvard did not have then. And when we talked nicely to the administration, they said, well, there's nothing Black to study. So end of conversation. So the next time we went with the Black Studies, with the Black Students Organization, we were not quite as polite, and we kept the dean in his office a little longer than he really wanted to be there. So I was kicked out of school for 2 years for that. Just incidentally, Harvard's African-American Studies Department is now their pride and joy. If you watch NPR, Henry Louis Gates Jr., with Finding Your Roots and all the wonderful Black history specials. He's the chair of that department. But not once has anyone sent me a thank you note for helping to start it. Okay, but anyway, during my 2 years of being booted from Harvard, I was sent down to Atlanta to organize again in the war. There was a GM strike on, we helped with that. All the New England radicals, when they heard I was going down to the Deep South, said, oh my God, you're going to be shot and lynched and burned and who knows what all by the Ku Klux Klan. But the very first time the car door opened in Atlanta and I smelled that warm honeysuckle air, I was just in love. And everyone was so friendly. Black and white people talk to each other just like a natural thing, which never happened in Boston. The schools had been integrated peacefully down here, which also did not happen in Boston, if you'll remember the busing crisis up there. So I was just in love with Atlanta, and I decided that I would come back when I got a chance. And so I did go back to Harvard and graduate, but I came back to Atlanta as soon as I could to become a poet.
Now, when you came back to Atlanta, and we off camera, so to speak, and discussed this, you wrote a little bit when you were in high school, didn't write at all. When you were at Harvard, you mentioned that they don't broadcast creative writing or creativity on any level there at Harvard, unless you want to run a business. So after Harvard, you in odd jobs began to recite poetry, and as I remember, you came to your first poem. So tell us about the odd jobs you worked first.
Oh, well, my very first job was actually at Fort Worth City Sewer, I was digging ditches, so you and cleaning out very large, somewhat smelly sewer tanks. So you could truly say that I started at the bottom. So it was all uphill from there. However, after I graduated from Harvard, I was convinced by that time that I did not want to be part of the ruling class who I had met and had disagreements with in college. So I was just kind of floating around like a lot of people after the anti-war movement and doing odd jobs. And I was reading poetry and memorizing poetry and sort of reciting poetry to myself while I was doing these sort of typing and filing and calculating jobs. And by golly, poetry started to come to me. And I thought, well, this may be the answer. This may be what I'm meant to do.
What intrinsic value do you find in memorizing?
I think it's the very heart of poetry. I just think it's essential. If you want your poems to be memorable, at least you should memorize them, if no one else. I had a job with the San Diego school system actually doing poetry recitals. Pretty amazing job. So for that, I found the best times to memorize were just before you went to bed at night and just as you wake up in the morning. If you review what you're memorizing then, you could just memorize enormous amounts of stuff. And also, Mozart composed music in his head. He would go for a carriage ride and come back and sit down and write it out at incredible speed because it was all in his head. He was actually not composing. He was just writing stuff down. So there's just something so intimate and personal about that. Working with things in your head and in your memory. And it comes out that way then when you do the poetry orally. And that's the origin of poetry. It was poets going around to villages and, performing memorized poetry. That's our roots.
Tell us about the first poem you ever wrote.
I'll do more than tell you about it. I'll recite it.
Please do.
It's called A Word With You. And I wasn't intending to be a poet during my lost period after Harvard. I didn't know what I was going to do. And as a result, this poem just formed itself in my head and flopped itself in my lap at some point. It just came out all at once. It's called A Word With You. I live in the reflections of the day, the anxiousness, the hurrying, the fear, seeing myself no deeper than the eye, fixed and outward staring of the mirror, can see its darker face. But when I spoke with you, my dear, this icy prison cracked and far away spread misty views of many a hidden place. There, with this first soft light of day, we may wander about these lost realms as we please. Together find what sort of creatures breed along these untried paths that lead away past green and yellow field and stream and tree, back into a quiet place and free.
You said, again, off camera, that it's a sonnet now, but you didn't know that to begin with. It just came to you in pieces. Tell us about the technical side of that, how it came to be and how you put it on paper.
I really don't remember, but it might have been 13 or 15 lines, and I thought, oh, well, it's on, it's 14 lines, so I may have condensed it somewhat or expanded it a little, but I didn't tinker with it. That's what it was how it came out.
You mind giving us some of the backstory to the poem?
The backstory. Well, it's sort of about everyday life. I live in the reflections of the day. I mean, even more so now with all of our media stuff, you know, it's like we're just this pair of bulging eyeballs. And it's very tight and tense and sort of anxious, you know, age of anxiety kind of stuff. And that's how the surface is. That's the surface. And that's like the surface of the mirror. It's reflecting yourself back to you, but it's not very deep. In fact, it's less than a millimeter thick, and it can't see what's underneath. And so there was just this moment, actually a moment, I was talking with my girlfriend, and we just started talking about silly stuff, just useless stuff, which you spent your years and years and years striving, you know, so hard and to succeed by doing useful stuff. And here was this pleasant moment when we just had the leisure to be silly and talk about things that would never do us any good, that were utterly useless. And that was just so liberating. And so that was one of the inspirations behind that, just that little space of freedom after all those years in college.
When I met you, it was the Georgia Author of the Year of 2013, I think 2014, for Elephant Water, and it's still one of my favorite books. You have several books of poetry out there, Lunchboxes being the newest one that I'm aware of, but run us through all the poetry books that you've written specifically, and then we'll move into translations. Those are two different. So let's start with poetry.
Yeah, well, the poetry, those are the two. Elephant Water, I took 40 years to write. From the time I became a poet to the time I got that thing published. It also went through four different publishers who offered to write it and then behaved so terribly that I took it away from them or whatever. Came up with a terrible cover that I didn't like, wanted me to eliminate my favorite poem, et cetera, et cetera. So I finally got somebody to publish it with my own cover that I did myself. And that one, I was in love with Chinese painting at that, Chinese poetry at that point. And so I also got into Chinese painting with an actual Chinese brush, and I would hand rub the ink stick on an ink stone, just like the Chinese poets had done 1,000 years ago. And that was so much fun. So I did ink paintings for all the poems in there, either ink paintings or little pen sketches. And I still just love those little things. They were so much fun. So that made the book unique, but it also made it practically impossible to publish. I mean, poetry is hard enough to publish anyway, but I had found a way to make it even more difficult. So that took 40 years. The second book was Lunchboxes, and that was finished in record time in only 7 years. I was just dizzy when I crossed the finish line with that one. And I had very good luck with the publisher there, Iris Press in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where I'd gone to high school. And I loved Oak Ridge. Really, I have such fond memories of the place. So it was great to find that a little poetry press had established itself there and was publishing a lot of good people. So we just hit it off right away. And then another weird story. The poem was called Lunchboxes, which was the title poem. It was about the metal lunchboxes we used to carry to school. Of course, you know, the younger kids only carry plastic and sponge lunchboxes, so they can't hit each other over the head with them. But they trusted us back in those days. So we were trying to find a cover for this book. And we went back and forth, and the publisher finally said, "Do you know there's a lunchbox museum in Columbus, Georgia?" And I did a Johnny Carson, said, "I did not know that." So this I have to see. So I went down, we saw it, my partner Billie Jean came down with me, and basically we fell in love with Columbus. one really weird moment occurred at the Lunchbox Museum. The founder, Alan Woodall Jr., was there, and I showed him Elephant Water and all the Chinese ink paintings, and I had a Chinese ink painting of a 1957 Plymouth, probably the world's only ink painting ever of a 1957 Plymouth. So he got up and waved his finger and said, I want to show you something. We went back to this enormous garage he had in back of the museum, and there, sitting in his garage, were four 1957 Plymouths. So obviously we were kindred souls. And I was looking, you know, I had already handed off Atlanta Review to Georgia Tech at that time. I was sort of looking for a place with more nature, but still with culture to settle in. And we just really fell in love with Columbus at that point, got a house in the historic district. And that's why we're here, because of lunchboxes.
Now, tell us about how you came down to Atlanta and took hold of the Atlanta.
You did what now?
How did you get down to, came down to the South and took to the helm of the Atlanta Review?
Oh, okay. Atlanta Review. Well, like most great young poets, nobody was publishing us because the establishment was rigged, whatever. Some mysterious reason. So when I first got down here, I was intending to be a poet at that point. I already knew I wanted to be a poet. And people were telling me, you know, well, why do you come down here? There's nothing happening here. This is the backwater, Atlanta. There's nothing happening in literature. So I found out that wasn't really true. I mean, there was poetry going on, but it was going on in all these separate communities, the Black community, the gay community, the academic community, the wild in the streets, Little Five Points community, counterculture people. And it was great stuff. It was really fun stuff going on, but nobody knew about what the other, you know, side people were doing. So I thought, well, here I am, a radical organizer. Maybe I should organize poets. So I had a friend, Capers Limehouse, started a group called Poetry Atlanta Incorporated. We started a newsletter for all the poets, and people started coming to each other's readings, which is great. We started a reading series. We started publishing little books. And eventually, Capers Limehouse, that's her real name, by the way, had always wanted to start a literary journal. And I told her, no, you don't want to do that. You spend all your time reading bad poetry your whole life. So, but I failed to talk her out of it. She was determined. So I came up with the idea, well, if we're going to do this thing, let's go big and do an international feature once a year. Let's have an international poetry competition. And those things really worked great. I mean, our very first ad in Poets and Writers, we got like 10 crates of mail coming in. It's like, holy Moses, what have you started here? And so there was actually a group of us. There was a whole little sort of poetry commune. Alicia Stallings was in it, A. Stallings, now famous. She's the Oxford professor of poetry now. Mimi Curtis Tucker, Lee Passarella, a whole bunch of people. We were all reading things collectively and scoring all the manuscripts. Well, eventually all those people discovered that everything I had said was true. It was a lot of work. And people left town and drifted away generally and kind of left me holding the bag. But by then I discovered that I loved doing this stuff. I mean, it was like going down into a jewel mine or a gold mine and digging around among all the stuff and finding these wonderful treasures that no one had ever seen except for me and the poet. So, you know, I just loved it, and I was just happy to keep it going. I kept it going basically in my spare bedroom for more than two decades. It was one of the few really major poetry journals that was totally supported by its own readers. We did have some incredible luck early on. The contest and the international issues were popular. And then Atlanta had the Olympics in 1996. And we weren't allowed to use the word Olympics in our title because it was illegal. But we did come up with an Atlanta gold issue, and the title was in gold and everything. And everybody wanted it. This thing was distributed all over the world. And this was the biggest poetry issue in the world at that time for a two-year-old magazine by far. I mean, like, it was three times as big as Poetry Magazine, that one issue. And that really got us kickstarted. And after that, we got an Irish issue with Seamus Heaney, Caribbean issue with Derek Walcott. We just started getting all these big names. We more or less discovered Ha Jin. We published his poetry before he won the National Book Award for Fiction. So there was a lot of luck, but also a lot of hard work and sort of risk going into it on the front end.
Now, the public have just heard the enormous amount of time and gift and attention into this one project. What they don't know, what the public doesn't know, is that you're a translator and you're a musician. So before we get into the music part, let's talk about your translations. Start with that, please.
Yeah, well, from back in my 20s and in college, I was just in love with Chinese poetry, as I said. Also Spanish. I used to recite Garcia Lorca down into the stairwell of my Harvard dorm just to hear the echo coming back up. I mean, I'm totally an oral poetry. All right. I'm an oral poetry person. I got to hear it. And Spanish, of course, is such a beautiful language. So I ended up majoring in Spanish, but also studied Anglo-Saxon there. So I knew both of those languages pretty well. There was an odd coincidence at that point because Jorge Borges, the famous Argentine author, was giving the Norton Lectures at Harvard when I was there. And I was one of like two or three undergraduates who managed to get into one of his classes. All the bigwigs were sitting there on the front row, but we got to sit in the back and there was a course on Argentine literature, a full semester course with Jorge Borges. And I was studying Anglo-Saxon at the same time with Professor Alfred. And having gone to high school in Tennessee, and my mom was from Tennessee, my dad was from Kentucky, Professor Alfred was thrilled with my accent. He said, "You have a natural Anglo-Saxon accent." And my mom and dad would use a lot of funny little words that I've actually found out came from Anglo-Saxon, and had dropped out of standard English at that point. So whenever we came to an important passage in Beowulf or some other poem, really well-loved poem, Professor Alfred would always put his hands together in prayer and say, "Mr. Veach, could you please read this for us?" Which probably pissed off all the graduate students enormously. I was the only undergraduate in this class. But I had the natural Anglo-Saxon accent. So when I went through South America years later to do some thesis research, supposedly, I went to Argentina, and Jorge Borges was the director of the National Library. So I traipsed into the National Library, asked to see Jorge Borges, and they sent me right up. And he said, "Oh, you're a student of Professor Alfred's." And so he goes to the shelf, and he's blind, almost blind by this time. He can only see it at one little corner of his eye. He looks up on this bookshelves and finds this old, well-worn copy of Beowulf in Anglo-Saxon, takes it down, finds a passage, and he says, "Mr. Veach, could you please read this for me?" So I got to read Anglo-Saxon to Jorge Borges. And Anglo-Saxon was his favorite language. He considered it the world's most beautiful language. And he wrote stories about it. He was very fluent in Anglo-Saxon. So there was that very weird coincidence there.
What translations do you have? What body of work in translations do you have now?
I have a translation of Beowulf and all the major Anglo-Saxon poems. It's the only one with really all the major stuff in one volume, including Judith, which is the only epic poem, as far as I know of, with a sword-wielding female hero. And all these have just come out quite recently. I have a translation of the Cid, the Spanish epic, and it's the only translation that also includes the folk ballads about the Cid, the ones that the poets would actually go around and recite in the villages along with the epic poem. And some of these are extremely funny and extremely naughty. So that was a very fun volume to put together. I got a translation of Garcia Lorca's Gypsy Poems. It's the only book in English that has both his Romancero Gitano, the Gypsy Romances, and his book about flamenco, Poem of the Deep Song, which is entirely devoted to gypsy flamenco players. Just wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. So this is the first time of, putting those two books with all of Garcia Lorca's gypsy poems together. Let's see. And just recently, just this past year, I came out with a translation of Tao Yuan Ming, who's my favorite Chinese poet. And I have an unpublished book of Wang Wei's life and works, if anyone out there is interested in publishing it. It's also unique in the fact that Wang Wei had an incredibly interesting life. He actually was the person who stood next to the emperor in court and was charged with correcting any mistakes the emperor might make. So when the emperor misspoke, I mean, imagine someone doing this for Trump. So very diplomatically, no doubt. But and then he was in the imperial secretariat, and they would go back and write up all the stuff that had transpired in court. Then there was a rebellion against the emperor. And the rebels captured Wang Wei, and they forced him to work in their secretariat as well, which he did not want to do, but he also did not want to die at that point. So when the emperor finally came back, the rebels were suppressed. Wang Wei was put on trial for treason because he had worked for the enemy. Luckily, when he was in prison, a friend of his had come to prison, and Wang Wei had managed to smuggle two poems out written on the back of Buddhist sutras. And his friend smuggled two poems out of prison. And they talked about, how tragic it was, how sad it was that the Imperial Orchestra, for instance, had to play for these rebels. They were forced to play for the rebels. One musician actually started crying and actually was killed on the spot. So this poem actually convinced the court that Wang Wei was innocent, that he had been forced to serve against his will. So just amazing stuff like this happening throughout his life. So it makes a perfect combination to do a life story along with his extremely amazing poems. Well, I've gone on too long about that, but I am very excited about it.
Now, the excitement is what makes people listen. Now, let's touch on your musical side of life.
Yes. I started playing clarinet in junior high school, and I played in bands and also some orchestras, community orchestras and college orchestras for a long time. And then because of the rehearsal times and stuff, I had to quit for 10 years. When I came back, I found that I would have to go from being a first clarinet to being a third clarinet at that point. So I thought, well, I'll do something different. So I got a bass clarinet, which is about 4 feet high, very big, beautiful instrument. It has exactly the same fingering as the regular clarinet. So it's, and the music is written in the same staff, even though it sounds an octave lower. So very easy to start playing bass clarinet. And it just has a sound like nothing else on earth. It's, I compare it to playing an earthquake. So I did that in Atlanta in community orchestras and bands, and I'm also doing the same down here in Columbus.
What peace does playing music get?
What peace
of mind does music give you?
What pieces?
What peace of mind does playing music?
If you're actually playing it, the peace of mind is more in the listener than for you. The nobles in 18th century Europe had their servants play the instrument so they could listen to them at dinner. And that's pretty much the way it should go. I mean, if you want to relax to music, you should not be the one playing it in general. But it is fun. I mean, it's just being sitting in the middle of an orchestra in the middle of all that sound. There's just nothing quite like it. But it is a totally different experience than actually listening to the music.
How does music play into your, as a listener, how does that play into your creative process?
Into my what?
How does it play into your creative process, listening to music while you're running?
Oh. I think it's very similar. During COVID, I knew I would have a lot of time indoors, so I decided to take a classical guitar very late in life. And it's one of those things, practicing is kind of like watching the hour hand of a clock. You know, you're not thinking the needle is moving, but over the course of months and years, it does. You are getting better, whether you realize it or not. So that there's sort of that cooperation with an inner something that's actually better than you are and knows more than you do.
Right.
And it's very much the same as being a poet. You have to figure out a way to cooperate and be open to that and work with it.
Well, I know all the listeners out here want to be a part of and hear the notes you play on the page in translation and in your own poetry. So how do we find your work online to bring it home?
Music? Okay, well, I'm part of an orchestra, so you don't... You know, there's only very small solos, usually for the bass clarinet. If you go to the Facebook page of the Columbus Community Orchestra, they had a concert last fall in which I had a big solo in a piece called Mary's Boy Child. So big, actually, that I actually bought all the orchestral parts and asked the orchestra to play it. Which they were happy to do. So there you can actually hear the bass clarinet take off and have some fun.
As far as buying your translations and your poetry books, how do we get hold of those?
Let's see. All the translations I've talked about, except for Wong Wei, are published. The Beowulf is published by Lockwood Press. The Cid and the Garcia Lorca are published by a publisher called Stockcero, S-T-O-T-K-C-E-R-O. It's a Spanish language academic publisher. in America here. And Returning Home is in the White Pine Press's Companions for the Journey series. It's a lovely little small volume designed to be pocket-sized, so you can take it out in the woods and read all the Taoyuan Ming you want.
Well, Dan Veach, it has been tremendous honor to have you on this program. And for those who want to know more about you, you're going to be in the next issue of the Blue Mountain Review with Billy Bob Thornton on the cover. Yes. So as your work continues, as your music continues to flow, if I could ever have you back on this program for any reason, Dan Veach, you please let me.
Wonderful. I would love it.
Well, y'all, another hour has come and gone with Dante's Old South. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and this has been an honor to sit here and share this time with you. I want to thank again Lucid House Publishing, The Crown Restaurant, Mercer University Press, UCLA Writers Extension Program, NPR, WTC, Richard Wenham, and Michael Amade. And to check out more about me, your host, Clifford Brooks, go online at www.cliffbrooks.com to see not only more about me, but also the magazine, the Blue Mountain Review, and those affiliated with me on the staff that help make all these projects and life in general say. Y'all be nice to one another. Be nice.